I would like to say thank you for the time this morning. It is the first time I think that I have presented at the at this function. I have at the short-term one and at the main one, but never at this one. And it's nice to see a lot of familiar faces here. And I think when Donovan contacted me a couple of weeks ago to ask me if we'll do a presentation on ORSA today, I think my first thought was, sure, that's quite a dull topic, you know. I think it's a bit overdone. Most people know about it. What can we do to make it a bit more interesting? But I think I speak for both Kavi and myself in preparing for today, kind of re-going through the journey that we've been on with, I think it's probably more than 20 clients to get them ready for the mock ORSA and the journey that we'll continue with them. I think we did find it an extremely useful process. I always say that the ORSA for me is the mirror of how well you are doing with your SAM implementation. It gives a very good idea for me to what extent the principles underlying SAM, because I think sometimes we forget what SAM is trying to do. It is actually trying to do something useful if you look through all the gumph and the compliance, and to what extent you have been able to take that useful bits of it and actually put it into the nuts and the bolts of your organization. So I think the ORSA is really a good way of having a look at that. And I think the industry has come quite a long way. If you think 2 years ago, Klaas, I mean, you can attest to this as well, looking after the ORSA working group, the questions around what is the ORSA, what should be in the report. Don't worry, I'm not covering that. In case anyone is worried, I'm not going to cover that. But to a point where on the 31st of August, pretty much everyone submitted a mock ORSA report. Although some of them limped there, if we're honest about it, but these ORSA reports were submitted. So what Kavi and I are going to try and do today is we're going to share some of our stories and key observations of the journey we've been on. And I think I want to put an emphasis on we. It is Kavi and my, it's our personal views, and it could definitely be biased by the clients we worked with, but we did work with some of the large groups as well as some of the smaller niche guys. So hopefully across life and short term, so hopefully there will be some balance to it. And I also look forward to when we get to the time of asking questions, or when we get to tea, if any of you feel free to share some of your stories, because I'm sure there are a couple of hair-raising ones or funny ones or things like that. So just maybe a bit of a stock take on the mock ORSA and just a couple of high-level observations. Now, like I said, most people actually did submit something. Most of the insurance companies that were part of groups just submitted a group ORSA. And I think one of the big things that was debated over in the preparations was how long should this thing be? Based on what we saw, I would benchmark about between 40 pages and 120. It's kind of like where most people fell into that bracket. And the amount of effort that went into producing these mock ORSAs varied widely across the industry, ranging from the one-man band starting a month before and the board not seeing it at all, to very big company-wide projects engaging actuarial, finance, risk, that was probably project managed, where the board actually did see it, did get an opportunity to comment. But I think it's important to understand it was very wide-ranging. And the other thing is, it's also there's still quite a big gap. For some companies, it was literally their first ORSA. Like I said, the boards haven't seen it. For others, it's actually quite a well-established process. For one of our clients, it was their fifth or sixth one that they actually did. So the board was very familiar with it, have given quite a lot of feedback as to what they want to see in it. But it's also maybe fair to say that a lot of the guys that have produced their ORSAs quite a number of times are also some of the companies that are part of IMAP, where I think the focus to get ready for IMAP has forced a greater urgency to get those ORSAs in front of the boards more regularly to meet the use test requirements as well. Now, if we're honest about it, my personal view is the bulk of the industry still treated this submission as a compliance exercise in the main, and that I don't, Kavi will talk a little bit about risk culture in a little while, and that there was not that much benefit obtained from a lot of these mock authors that were produced. It was just compliance. If for some of them, where they did go to more effort, I think the main areas, just in brief, where I think the most value was obtained was through the scenario analysis process, which I think highlighted quite a couple of useful things to the board and executive management if they went through a robust process, and also the projections, getting that full balance sheet and income statement view, which especially on the short-term side is not something that really existed before. And then just in summary, I think, as I said, there's a wide range of practice, both in the report and how the processes are implemented. But in general, I would say that it is our view that there is still considerable work required to make the production of the author a painless process, and also to make sure that it's fully compliant with what the regulator would want. Sorry, I will get this right as we progress.
Okay, so can everyone hear me? Yeah. For the next part of the presentation, we'll take you through as what Asumri mentioned was some of the lessons learnt from our perspective, some of the observations, and we've tried to also highlight areas of key focus. And in going through the also, we've divided our observations into five key areas, which seemed to make sense as we went through them. The first one is use and embedment. Then communication, the author process itself, technical aspects, and then we'll finish off with, as Sumri mentioned as well, the risk culture and the sponsorship for the author process. So starting off with use and embedment.
I'm not there yet. Sorry, Kavi.
No worries.
There we go.
I think this is obviously a very challenging area, probably the key most challenging area for the author, for the industry. The extent to which it was used and was embedded in the business varies widely across the industry. I think there are a number of organizations, particularly those with who've established ERM frameworks and have been using them for some time, or have been implementing them in the business for some time, where actually the also was reasonably well used for certain things. But I think for most of the industry, this was, and certainly for the mock also, it was seen as an exercise of compliance, really. Just to the focus was really to get a report out. I think the author as a whole is quite challenging, especially for the smaller companies. But the large companies have their challenges too, and the focus for the mock also really was just can we produce something that the regulator is going to be happy with. So I think there's quite a lot of work to be done in using the author and embedding it in the business. And in order for the rest of the industry and those without the well-established ERM processes to really get there, a few things need to happen. The first one is really a change in attitude by senior management and some of the boards, certainly some of the ones that we've dealt with, in order to see the author as not just a pure compliance exercise. I think it goes hand in hand with fitting the author into the organization. So it's supposed to be a bespoke process. And while I mentioned practice does vary across the industry, I think there is there is still quite a lot of work to do to really customize also processes and really fit them into the organizations in a way that works. And I think if that happens, we'll see a change from the senior management and boards in the industry to seeing it more than a compliance exercise and looking to derive some value from it. Also, what needs to happen is turnaround time. So in our experience, in a number of organizations where the ORSA is actually used, we can see the turnaround times for producing capital numbers and projections are quite long. It takes a lot of organizations over a month to produce projections of future solvency, and several weeks to produce solvency assessments. And I think in order to ensure that ORSA is used more widely in the organization, those turnaround times really do need to shorten. There's also quite a big education gap with a number of boards. Some of them are obviously more advanced than others, but there isn't as much understanding as there should be, I think, in boards on what value can actually be derived from the ORSA, what information they should be looking for, and where they can actually use it in decision making. If these things are focused upon in the next year or two, I think we'll see a lot more use of the ORSA. There are obviously a few use cases that have been explored, but only just a few. In general, what we've seen, again, particularly with the smaller organizations, the key area where the ORSA has been used is to really get an understanding of the risk profile of the business for the first time. And to get an understanding of the capital drivers that really drive the capital requirements. But in general, the amount of value derived from the ORSA will vary from organization to organization, and it is natural for it to do so. I think the more risk and the more uncertainty there is in the organization, the more value you ultimately get from the ORSA. So if you have a large capital buffer, a very stable book of business, a very simple business, very simple investments, the amount of value that you'll get from an ORSA process will be much less than if you are much closer to your solvency margin with only a little leeway, a very complex investment portfolio, a very dynamic business that's changing quite a lot. The ORSA will obviously find a lot more use in that sort of organization, because solvency management is a much bigger deal. But across the board, I think more needs to be done to derive value out of the ORSA. There were, however, in our experience, a few interesting use cases that are worth mentioning, apart from the very low hanging fruit which I mentioned earlier. For some of the smaller organizations, the beefed up, as I call them, projection models, so in order to produce projections of future solvency, it required more investment into budgeting and forecasting processes that finance teams have developed. And for some of them, the automation of this and the increase in the accuracy of these processes actually added a lot of value. And the finance team themselves actually got a lot of value from it. Assessing the impact of corporate insurance. So this was a particular case where the company had actually built and invested quite a lot in an operational risk model. And so the model also considered the corporate insurance that was being purchased, and risks to assets, as well as risks to potential liabilities that the company may face, and there was a very interesting exercise which we did in order to optimize or identify gaps in the corporate insurance and look at actually how it's priced. Actually, very similar to a reinsurance optimization or a reinsurance analysis exercise. Acquisitions and investment mix impacts. There was quite an interesting case about a month ago where a fairly large organization was looking to change the mix of cash investments. And what was interesting for me anyway is you wouldn't think the introduction of a new bank, for example, would have a big impact on solvency or would need that much consideration. It is, after all, a cash investment. But I think given the way that standard formula works and the concentration risk charges, there was actually a fair amount of analysis that was done around introducing the new bank, the credit ratings that would be permissible. Stress and scenario testing is one of the key areas as well where a lot of value can be derived. For a number of organizations that we worked with, there was a lot of focus on very extreme stresses. So reverse stress testing was done, but the stresses and scenarios that were derived tended to be very extreme, on the order of 1 in 100 years, 1 in 200 years. So you know, not things that people would expect to see in their working careers. And for those sorts of stresses, they're obviously very useful for resolution planning, recovery planning, but they tend not to speak to the business strategy that much. For one client, there was a particular emphasis on risks to business strategy, and while the extreme stresses were done, also focused quite a lot on much milder events, so 1 in 5 years, 1 in 10 years, things that you would expect to see but are still reasonably extreme events. And there was a fair amount of discussion and quite a lot of value that came out of that discussion, and a lot of input into their strategy processes more generally. So embedding the author and deriving value from it in general is definitely going to be a focus for the industry going forward. And there are two key areas that the industry really needs to place a lot of emphasis on. The first one is really getting the various stakeholders in the business to buy into it and to use it in their day-to-day work. And as I mentioned earlier, I think turnaround times and engagement with those stakeholders is key to doing that. But also, I think training. We sit in quite a number of board meetings. In fact, I was sitting in one about 2 weeks ago, where we're presenting on the mock also, and the board basically said, we're fine. We don't need any more training. We just want to see the results of the also. And after working through the report and presenting it, there was very little challenge, even though there was quite a lot of analysis, and I thought quite a lot that the board could have challenged us on. We really didn't get enough challenge. And to me, it points to more training and more understanding being required from boards.
So I think one of the key things or key tools that was also going to help with the use of the AUSA is the AUSA report, and that's the bulk of what sits under this communication section. And it always makes me think of a meeting Kavi and I had 2 years ago. This always comes to mind for me, with the FD of one of the larger insurance groups locally, who told me, Sumri, what I need is we need to write the Wilbur Smith of AUSAs. Now, this is, for me, actually an excellent way of thinking about it, because what is he on about here? He wants you to tell the story of risk and capital within the business in a succinct and clear way that is engaging for the reader. Now, I don't think anyone has gotten to the Wilbur Smith version yet, but I do think, replace his name with someone else if you think he's not the best writer. But I think aspiring to that is one of the key things for me. I think this also report can actually help to quiet some of the noise that we're getting on a lot of the risk committees from the independent non-execs especially. I think the awareness of the responsibility that they are taking on the board is increasing, and I think they're more and more worried, and especially on the risk committees that I'm sitting on, the actuarial guys, the risk guys get challenged quite a bit on the governance side by the independent non-execs. Now, the trick is to get these guys to engage with a report. I was sitting in a risk committee meeting 2 weeks ago where the one independent non-exec was giving the head of risk quite a hard time around governance, and they were asking questions. And I was sitting there thinking, well, you know, all these questions are actually answered in your ORSA report. The only sad thing is that these execs haven't actually seen the report yet. And they're insisting on additional work. And it's actually that gap at the moment that I think is causing a lot of friction on with the independent non-execs. Now, one of the things I think that makes it hard for them is they look at these ORSA reports, some of them that see them, and they don't feel familiar because of the fact that it's just like this dump of processes. It hasn't been customized sufficiently so that they recognize it as something that is bespoke and specific to the risks within this organization. So I think that's very important. And I think the way in which the legislation has been drafted, which is more principle-based rather than hard rules, do give you the opportunity to actually make the thing your own and tell your story. There is a question about the approach that the regulator will take. But I mean, if you ask my opinion, the ORSA report for a large life group like Liberty and the ORSA report that you produce for a personal lines, retail-linked insurance company like JD, they shouldn't look the same. They shouldn't contain the same things. And I think that balance, if we can get that right, that will help quite a lot. Now, the other thing is, like I said earlier, I think very often the ORSA reports at the moment is just a dump of information from a variety of sources. When we go back to that comment about Wilbur Smith, right, your ORSA report is supposed to be an executive summary of how you manage risk within your business and how much capital you need to cover residual risk, if we take it simply and we don't look at the forward. And I hope I'm not offending anyone by making this comment, but for me, if I sit in a board meeting and head of risk comes up and they put up a presentation to provide a summary of the ORSA report, it tells me that they have not cracked actually telling that story. And I did encounter that quite a number of times, that presentations was used to summarize the ORSA report. Now, what do I think industry needs to focus on? I think what we've been focusing on, like Kavi pointed out, is we've been thinking about what does the regulator want? How do we keep the regulator happy? Now, my question is, I think we should be thinking about how do we make the board and the risk committee love the ORSA report, right? How do we get that to happen? And maybe then the key question to ask there is, can we get to a point where the ORSA report actually replaces the risk committee pack? And I think that's one of the key challenges I want to put out there.
So on the ORSA process, then, I think, as Sumri mentioned, it's quite a challenge to produce an integrated report. But more than that, what we've seen is getting the various stakeholders on the ORSA to work together and dividing the roles and responsibilities in a sensible way has also been a fairly challenging process, particularly when it comes to the division between risk, actuarial, and finance. And there's no fixed model on how to break these responsibilities down. What we've seen in the industry is that it tends to the work tends to find the skills. So wherever the deepest skills lie and whoever's capable, that's where the most of the work tends to go. Certainly when it comes to risk and actuarial, there are a number of risk functions within the industry which have very limited actuarial skills. And in those cases, a lot of the risk work on the ORSA or the actuarial work, the actuarial components of the ORSA, tend to fall onto the actuarial department, with risk taking on a lot more of the ERM type focuses. Whereas for other organizations, there are actually actuarial skills in the risk management function, and there we see, you know, the risk management function actually doing a lot of the a lot of those assessments on solvency and capital requirements, and the actuarial function then being limited to things like the technical provisions and the valuations thereof. So and getting these different departments to work together in a completely integrated way has challenged, I think, both large and small organizations. In fact, we were busy with a smaller client about 6 months ago, where the finance division had actually produced the forecasts for a number of years and had forecast the technical provisions. Obviously, the way that they'd done it, being accountants, was obviously in an accounting way and reasonably simplistic. So it was quite a challenge to actually convince them why.
You should have said, "I hope I don't offend anyone."
I hope I don't offend anyone. yes, there was a lot more investment that went into the actuarial model in this particular case. So I feel justified saying it in this particular case. So we actually did need to convince them that this forecast of the technical provisions was a more accurate way. And in the end, we managed to integrate those two things together, and not only help the budgeting process but also help the ALSA process. The processes tend to be fairly unformalized at this stage. Like I mentioned, for the mock ALSA, a lot of the focus has been just getting a report out, and I think a lot more focus needs to go into formalizing the processes. I think this is an area where I think actuarial is quite a big culprit. From what we've seen, actuarial processes in general tend to be fairly loosely controlled, and there tends to be a lot more controls in say the finance divisions of organizations. So controlling these processes with key controls and making sure that they are not just well documented but fairly formal and streamlined is going to require some focus. There is limited governance and assurance, so independent assurance wasn't a requirement of this ALSA. I think that when you take a step back and look at it, though, there are pockets of assurance that are already being provided on various components of the ALSA. So while we wait for the regulator to issue firm guidance and final position on exactly what's going to be required on the independent review of the ALSA, to me, the key is really a combined assurance framework where we actually combine a lot of the assurances that already exist into an independent assurance of the ALSA, and that will obviously save a lot of effort. So the key focus for the future is definitely on making the processes safer and more streamlined, and I think if that's the focus, particularly in actuarial, again, I mentioned, it will support the use of the ALSA as well. In a number of organizations, there have also been errors picked up in quiz calculations that we've reviewed and been involved with, as well as the turnaround times that I mentioned. So if the industry tightens up on those two particular issues, I think it will support the use of the ALSA across the organization a lot more.
Okay, so Kavi mentioned actuarial processes not being controlled, and I think that's a very, very fair comment. So if we look at the technical aspects, I think we've just highlighted a couple here. And the first one we've got up there is the challenge to the appropriateness of the standard formula. It was excluded for purposes of the mock ALSA, and what we found is most companies didn't do it, because of the fact that, like I said, some of them started a month before as a one-man band, so there's no way that they were going to get to that. But even for some of the larger companies, I don't think that appropriate amount of work has gone into this, especially for the large groups. I think that's a very interesting one for me. I mean, Kavi and I were involved with a large group that actually did attempt to do this. And it's a challenging situation if you're part of a group where not all the entities are financial services entities. So say, for example, if you have a large property company as part of that group, where the balance sheet of that property company is equal in size to all the insurance entities put together, how do you decide how much capital to hold for that? And it's actually quite a challenging process. It's actually, I think for all of us as actuaries, from a theoretical perspective, it's quite a fun process, but it is actually quite a challenging process to get that right. And I'm not always sure if we all have the right skills to do that. Or the other interesting one is, how much capital do you have to hold for 150 buffalo? I'm not sure, but Gary and I did come up with something. But I think that's definitely a challenge that still exists. Now, on the balance sheet projection side, a lot of time and effort went into this. And I think there's still a wide-ranging practice between the level of detail, the amount of pragmatism that people used. There's not even, in what we've seen for some of the larger group, there's not even consistency between divisions or between the entities. Some of them took an approach where they were very approximate. Some of the other entities or divisions were more detailed. So this is one of the areas that I think going forward, there will still also be quite a bit of work needed. And then the last one I just want to highlight, I mean, this wouldn't be a group of actuaries if we didn't talk about data, right? So one of the challenging bits about the ORSA that we need to face is that there is, ORSA is bringing together very closely risk, finance, and actuarial. And these three things or groupings have separate data sources very often. Now we're trying to produce one set of consistent numbers out of these data sources. And that is causing a large amount of additional cost being incurred. It's slowing the process down to ensure that the recons work. If you look, one of the largest reinsurers worldwide has been, over the last 2 years, spending a considerable amount of money in getting one common data platform that will be used by all three of these entities. So there's no need to do reconciliation between the numbers, because in their view, it's one of the critical things that you need to get right to make sure that you can streamline, like what Kavi spoke about, and that you also don't break the bank in getting that streamlining right. So if I had to highlight one focus area out of all of this that we haven't highlighted yet, is this whole issue of challenging the standard formula and whether it's actually appropriate for your business. There's a large amount of value to be gained from that. In the processes where people actually did do it, where Kavi and I were involved, it actually does increase the understanding of the true risks within the business. Now, the tricky bit with that is it does require time of already stretched teams that's just struggling to produce the numbers, and that also means budgets that needs to be approved. And that then brings me, links nicely to Kavi talking about stakeholder management.
Yeah, so culture and sponsorship. It's always interesting as a consultant, because we work across the industry to see the different cultures and the different way different organizations approach the same problem. And what we've observed is a wide range of the level of sponsorship from the executive team and from boards. I think in some organizations, you know, we're engaged directly by the CEO or the CFO, and they're intimately involved in both the SAM and the ORSA process, and, you know, challenging us and directing us every step of the way. And in other organizations, it tends to be, you know, delegated down to sometimes the most junior risk manager. You know, our key contact and client is that person. And what's striking is just, you know, how much the difference in terms of what's achieved and how the ORSA is perceived in the organization in those two extremes. I think definitely, you know, without exception, where the executive and board are intimately involved, We see horses of a lot greater quality. It's much more widely accepted within the organization, and a lot more investment is obviously given towards the horse. In the other case, as one client put it to me, it's like herding cats in a thunderstorm. He just really wasn't getting anywhere. The stakeholders in the organization really weren't giving the sufficient time to the horse. And so there's definitely a level of, and we're not suggesting that this needs to be the key focus of the entire executive team, but there's definitely a level of sponsorship that's required at a board and an executive level in order to establish the process and make sure that the ORSA is used properly. And as I mentioned once before, it also needs to fit in with the culture. So it's also very interesting to see the different decision-making cultures. Some clients are very entrepreneurial and run their business, some would say, by the seat of their pants a little bit. Even though the businesses are quite large, decisions are made, on the fly. Governance and risk management tend to be seen as, hindrance to sort of progressing business. Whereas in other organizations, governance and risk management are given a lot more focus and due process needs to be followed every step of the way. And I think the ORSA and the way it's implemented needs to reflect that. You can't have a very cumbersome ORSA process. Even though Sam is saying everything needs to be very well controlled and very well governed, that's certainly true to a level of compliance, but you need to fit in with the culture of the organization if you want the ORSA to be accepted and used widely across the organization. In terms of the area of focus, I think we're also at an interesting point in terms of ORSA, but also in terms of risk management generally. As I mentioned, many organizations have had ERM functions and risk management functions for some time. But for most of the industry, and particularly the short-term insurance industry, and particularly the smaller clients, I would say, risk management is something new, and risk management functions have only really been established and given a lot more focus over the last 2 or 3 years. Across the industry, we see people still finding their feet in some ways in risk management. There's a very big challenge that I think faces risk management functions and also processes together, and that's really to justify more investment and more attention in that area. I think for most people who work in these areas, maybe biasly, but most of them would argue that there hasn't been enough investment, and there hasn't been, we see lots of teams who are stretched in terms of resources, and people really struggling to keep up with all of the requirements. But in order to get that investment, I think that the challenge for risk management is to deliver value. And we're actually working with a client at the moment, one of the larger clients, who really is taking this challenge head on. So they've implemented quite a large risk management function and recruited some fairly senior people. Some of the best talent in the organization has gone into the risk management function. It's very expensive, of course, but the challenge here is really how do we deliver value, not just complying and using the ORSA, but actually deliver real value to the organization that creates value for shareholders. In summary, I think looking back, for those of you who've been involved with SAM for quite some time, 5 years ago, we were staring at this challenge and wondering if we would ever get there. So, seeing the industry submit mock ORSAs really is a proud moment for the industry, I think, because it's been a long journey. I think the overarching theme across our presentation, though, is that this is the first step, and there's still quite a long way to go, not just in terms of compliance and not just in terms of meeting what the regulator wants, but in terms of actually seeing the also used and delivering real value to the rest of the organization. Welcome, any questions?
Pleasure.
Thank you for that. If you can just indulge me on maybe a couple of comments and then a question. So just from, Andy Rayner from Discovery. Just from our experience, we did an also for our two regulated insurance entities in South Africa, as well as our group, so three horses. And we didn't do them for the UK operations yet. They have their own requirements. We worked really hard to keep them to about 6 to 7 pages. And that made the group one easier that we've done the individual entities. In terms of board engagement, we had extensive engagement over probably a 6-month period with risk committees, actuarial committees, management Mexico's, group Mexico, board training days, focus days. So we extensively communicated with the board and the non-execs particularly. And the feedback from them was they found it really useful as a way of focusing on the key risks that they were kind of aware of but maybe couldn't always contextualize. I think also going through that process led to two specific changes to the business model that I can just recall off the top of my head. So one of them around a capital allocation issue, another one around a business process. So again, really did throw up some real good insights in the business. What else can I say? In terms of actuarial engagement, so our group risk management function has a very strong second line actuarial component.
Yeah.
And so that really played into our hands as well, let's say, in terms of just getting one team to pretty much coordinate the activities and do a proper second line. The first line, who are also very competent and skilled, were doing this. So that was good for us. And I think where I sort of see, I agree with your point, the work in the future that needs to be done now is, I think the appropriateness of the standard formula is an interesting area. I was going to ask you a question about that. Answered already. And streamlining and making these things faster, getting the actuarial models, you know, a bit more streamlined. So it's definitely some common things that we've experienced in the background for the presentation. Just in terms of questions, one of the things that, and this is a consultant's ideal question from the floor, but so how do you see the external review process working with these horses once we get into proper external review? In terms of, you know, not just the report, but the processes in business that support that, do you do it on a rolling basis? How do you see this external review process unfolding?
Okay, Kavi, do you wanna answer that?
Sure.
Kind of falls into.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I think our views is definitely the combined assurance one. I think as I mentioned, there are a number of assurance providers already in these processes. So internal audit looks at a number of processes in the business. There are a number of organizations who've implemented model governance and model validation processes within the actuarial functions. So it's really about tying all of those things together, and I think the amount of independent assurance or assurance to be provided obviously depends on the importance of this process to the board. And in different organizations, it does vary. So as I mentioned, in some organizations, this is absolutely critical because they're really on the margin to solvency. In other organizations, where the solvency margin is bigger, I think the assurance can be lighter. As to whether it should happen, every year or be spread out over a number of years, I think ideally it could be spread out because that would spread the cost, but I think that certainly from our engagements with the regulator, it does seem that they're probably going to insist on at least some sort of review on an annual basis.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. I think the main thing here is, and as I see it, there's already so many layers built into this thing. If you think also with PAC. On the numbers, on the role of internal audit with checking processes and controls and all those kind of things. It's important not to duplicate costs. I do think there is value in, and that's not just speaking from a consultant's perspective, in getting an external review of the report just in the sense that getting another viewpoint or some pointers on maybe where you can get more value out of what you're doing currently, that's very useful. But that's not really an independent assurance role. That's more like a benchmarking kind of role. It's not 100% clear to me exactly how the regulator is going to go about it. But for some of our clients that's in the IMAP process, the way we've approached it has been on this heavily combined assurance view, using the numbers being validated by the validation team that's doing it, internal audit playing a role, and external audit actually playing some role as well. And with all those three together, we did the review.
Colin Kinson, Adbot Mutual Assurance Society. I just want to get your views, and I know there will be guidance from AFSB forthcoming in terms of the timing of the ORSA, whether it should sort of follow the year-end process or should wait for the next strategic session to update, for example, those projections. So something to get your views on that.
Okay, I'll start and you can add, Kavi. I do hope that the regulator does not give firm guidance on this. I don't know where Klaas and his team is on that, but I hope that the regulator doesn't give firm guidance on it, because I think in order for this to work and to work for businesses, they need to decide where some of these things need to happen. And I think the report is a culmination of a number of processes, and these processes will happen right throughout the year at the right points in time for that to work. So you get people at the moment that is looking at producing their ORSA when they're doing their strategic planning. And then you get some that will do it after year end. I think doing it at year end, one of the tricky bits around that is it's already quite a strained process producing. So you're going to put a lot of additional strain on already stretched resources. And I'm not always sure if that is the place where some of these processes add the most value. So when you're doing a strategic planning, that's more where you want to look at your projections, want to look at your capital projections. So that's my personal view on it, but I'm not sure where it will end up. Yeah, Kavi?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. We get asked it a lot, and there is quite a lot of uncertainty also just in what's going to happen over the next year. So the number of clients who have 31 December year ends, wondering if they actually need to submit an ORSA in 2016, or whether they can wait until 2017, when SAM is in to submit an ORSA report. I think all we can do is consult with the regulator, because it is a little bit unclear at this point.
Thanks, Klaas.
Right, thank you for that very interesting presentation. Just got a little gift for you to say thank you.
Oh, cool. Thanks everyone for listening. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.